CF United, the premier Cold Fusion Conference by TerraTech Programming. Created by developers for developers.
All right, looks like we're about ready to get started. Before I get going, we got a couple of announcements. The first is that the Cold Spring Buff is going to take place at 7 p.m. today in Salon E, which I'm told is right behind us. The second is that parking on the lot is now free for the next 2 days. So get excited about that. All right, so with no further ado, my name is Max Porges. I'm lead software architect for CFI and Westgate Resorts, and today we're going to be talking about secrets of top-notch development teams. You may be sitting there thinking, why is a software guy telling us how to manage a development team? The story basically is that there's always a huge divide between management and techies. Normally you have managers who are totally non-technical managing a bunch of techies, and there aren't a lot of programmers who want to be managers and step away from the code, so you have this big divide. I was put in a position where we had a manager of our development team leave the company, and I was offered the position to manage the team, and being technical, I said, thanks but no thanks. Our CIO at the time said to me, listen, how about I bring you under my wing and I mentor you? You can have full autonomy of the department, do what you need to do, and work it out that way. So I thought, what's the worst thing that can happen? And you know, luckily under his leadership, I acquired some good management skills and was actually able to successfully manage a couple of development teams. So I figured there's a lot of programmers who have a tough time with their management, and a lot of managers who really don't understand what's going on with the techies. So let's bridge the gap is really what I'd like to do today. Real quick, let's do an informal poll. How many people here are developers or techies? Almost all of you. Look at that. How about managers? Don't be scared. How many managers? Very good. All right. I have to say, actually, this is one of the more popular talks that I've offered before, with just by the amount of people who are here. So it goes to show you how many people are interested in solving this particular problem. So, all right. So let's start off by talking about what great software teams, what kind of attributes there are for great software teams. One of the things that's really important in the software team is having the right kind of environment. You want to make sure that the environment's open forum, collaborative, and academic. What do those things mean? Well, open forum, you want to have an environment where anyone can speak up at any time and kind of throw an idea out there. Maybe it's a constructive criticism of the way you're doing something. Maybe it's an idea for a new technology or something like that. Having an open forum promotes collaboration, where people are working together to solve a particular problem or make something easier or better than it is today. And the academic environment, a lot of people who are technical like to have discussions about technology. They like to kind of dig into the finer points to understand it better themselves and maybe help educate their peers or learn something from their peers. So these are all things that if you have in your software team already, you're on the right track. And if you don't, definitely want to think about putting them in there. We're going to talk about how to do all of this as we go through the talk. Having a high level of professional respect between team members is essential. If you have guys on your team who always seem to be dragging their feet and everyone thinks their code sucks, that's not going to help. You want to make sure that you're spreading around the ability for everybody to learn from each other and to bring something to the table and be effective. Obviously, if you have people who just aren't cutting it, that's kind of a management decision. But you do want to make sure that you promote that professional respect by having your team members interact with each other and see the different skills that everyone brings to the table. One thing I've found with a lot of teams, either ones I've worked on or ones I've heard people talking about, the workload is not evenly distributed. You have a couple of superstar developers who are doing 80% of the work, and then you have like a couple of guys that do nothing but update images and change text on web pages all day. So that's something you definitely want to avoid, because you're going to burn out your superstars, and you're going to make people who really don't have the skill set that you need if they're just kind of changing images all day. And one thing that's often missing in software development shops is clear expectations. So again, we're going to talk about all of these things in the presentation. All right, so how do we create this environment that's going to promote all of these things that we want to have? A key piece of kind of understanding techies is that techies really are creative types. I think because software development started in, you know, mainframe labs with a bunch of guys with pocket protectors, the impression was always like, this is an engineering profession, it's very technical. The truth is that technology's kind of moved to the mainstream now. It's kind of cool to be a computer programmer and be a web developer. You definitely get a different response from people these days when you say you're a programmer and you build websites than you did maybe, you know, 20 years ago when you said, hey, I'd sit in the room and do punch cards all day. So software, really, it's more art than science, and you'll find this as you're building software, you start to discover this over time. If you're an experienced programmer, you already know what I'm talking about. So with that in mind, I have a quote that I love. Paul Graham, for those of you who don't know him, he's the guy who actually invented one of the first dynamic web applications ever, which he ended up selling to Yahoo for a crap load of money called Yahoo Stores. And if you guys have heard of that little project, he wrote a book called Hackers and Painters, which is really kind of a, he's actually a programmer and he enjoys painting. So he kind of draws some of the parallels between the creative side of software. And how the quote reads is, what hackers and painters have in common is that they're both makers. Along with composers, architects, and writers, what hackers and painters are trying to do is make good things. So you want to create that environment that will allow these guys to make good things. And if you're a manager, the easiest way to do that is to kind of get out of their way. So we're going to talk about that. Okay, so what are some of the things that developers value? Developers like being part of the solution, whether it's a business rule you're trying to implement on a piece of software, or you're trying to change the layout of the office, or you've got some kind of conflict that you're trying to solve internally. Because developers are problem solvers by nature, they want to be part of solving that problem. They like to learn and share with each other. Everyone here is a perfect example of people who want to learn and share. A lot of this is collaborative learning. If you're a manager and you're not familiar with the online communities and the different peer groups that people will work with to learn, it's a big part of being a developer. Everyone's usually trying to improve themselves and find newer and easier ways of doing things. Developers like to work on well-designed systems. There's nothing worse than working on a system that's a real bear to maintain. And every time you're like, hey, the customer wants a new feature, everyone's rolling their eyes and they're terrified to touch the code because they know it's just a huge beast. We talked a little bit about the clean requirements and clear expectations. Developers work best when they understand the problem and they can solve it. And sometimes helping them understand the problem so that they can solve it involves you changing the way that your SDLC works a little bit or getting your programmers closer to the customer. How many people here have been to one of the Agile talks this year? Quite a few of you. Okay, so Agile is this kind of, it's been around for a while, but it's become fashionable in the last year or so. For people to do agile techniques. And a lot of agile is about stripping away the BS and the formality and getting the programmers closest to the customers to understand their needs. So this is one of the things you can do to help having clean requirements. And again, setting clear expectations. Developers work best when they're given the problem and told to solve it, but they do need some boundaries within which to work. Most developers like to know what the development standards are. They kind of like to know the time frame within which they're supposed to be delivering something. So these things are all important. So how about team values? Well, if you're creating this environment for your developers, you have to place values somewhere. This is true for any management team. But where you place these values and how you reward and discipline the employees or change the way that you structure your department is going to affect how they react to it. Developers should always be rewarded for creating tight work, really good code, and clean solutions, and for bringing new ideas to the table that make things easier or better. Anything that's easier or better is going to save your company or your customer money. So these are things that you want to reward developers for. Open environments where you have this kind of collaborative situation, the beauty of this is that this kind of thing happens automatically. The developers kind of end up rewarding themselves for bringing new ideas to the table and for making their job more fun because they're using new techniques or new technologies. So what are some of these values? How can we kind of promote this so that this is working for us? Things that I tend to place high value on are community decision making. If we're going to bring a new technology and everyone gets together and says, hey, what's this reactor stuff? What's this crazy model glue framework that's just come out? And what can we do with that? Having the developers own a particular piece of the technology and bring it to the table gives everyone the opportunity to speak about whether or not that's something that you want to have. And in making the choices, the team on the technology, no one's sitting there saying, I hate this thing, I never wanted to code in this, and yet I'm being forced to do so. If it's brought to the table and everyone kind of decides on what you're using, it becomes a team decision. Development standards really should be made as a community situation. We're going to talk about development standards in detail a bit later, so I'm going to table that one. And any kind of disagreement resolution that you have, maybe two developers can't agree on a code review, and they're arguing over, well, this is faster than that, or this is easier to read than that. Getting everyone together and having the team make a collective decision is the best way to resolve those kind of situations. And if you're one of the managers in the room, you obviously need to mediate that so people aren't chopping each other's heads off, but you don't want to create the capability for developers to resolve conflicts amongst themselves. How many people in here work in shops where they do peer reviews? Not as many as I'd like to have seen. Peer reviews are essential. You have to have at least two sets of eyes and two sets of hands touching every piece of work that goes through your shop. It will be better as a result of two people or more looking at it. I consider myself a pretty good developer, but I've never presented anything to another developer that I didn't walk away with, either suggestions or even better ways of doing things that I hadn't thought of yet. So, and also, by doing peer reviews, each developer gets to see the other's work. This builds professional respect, because now I'm seeing something that, you know, Fred has built, and I'm like, hey, Fred had a really cool solution for this. Or maybe I'm saying to Fred, hey, I really liked everything you did here, but I have a suggestion, maybe this can be easier. And if the criticism's constructive, Fred's like, hey, you know what, Max just made me a better developer, you know, and we've now learned from each other. So this is building that kind of academic environment. If you don't have a software life cycle, that's something you definitely want to look at. It's kind of outside the scope of this discussion, but as work gets promoted through the life cycle, it should be getting looked at least two sets of eyes, because normally one person is handing off work to another. Whether it's your business analyst handing off work to the programmer, who's then giving the business analyst feedback saying, hey, I kind of don't understand these requirements, here's some of the things I'd like to see moving forward, or, you know, two developers doing code review or something like that. So where else can we place high value? Again, no ideas. I don't know how many people in here have had a job where you know, you've been working in the same technology for 10 years and you're just ready to blow your brains out. Or maybe it's, you know, just the same system and you're just sick of looking at it. And, you know, I see a lot of people in this environment, and most developers hate that. If you can create a foundation for developers to bring new ideas to the table and make it comfortable for them to bring new ideas without feeling like they're going to lose their job because they're, you know, storing up the pot, they're, again, going to bring you things to make their job easier. If their job's easier, they're going to work better, you're going to save money as a manager. And for a developer, you're going to love this because your manager's going to let you bring these new technologies in, and you get to see the results of that and make your job more fun. This is giving someone just a positive way to change their own workplace. I have a way that we like to bring new technologies in. I like developers to tinker with things either at work or away from work. I actually try to schedule people in to tinker with technologies because I know that time is going to be well spent when we save that time on the next project that we work on. So, and this is something you guys have probably all heard how Google does, like 20% of your week is nothing but tinkering. I can't quite afford to give my developers 20% of the week, but I can give them a couple hours. I don't know anyone, myself included, who can code effectively for 8 hours straight. I think most developers code for about 6 hours a day, and they can actually produce decent code. So what are they doing the other 2 hours of the day? They're eating, having the coffee break, you know, or maybe they're on the web looking at some new framework that just came out. As a manager, you shouldn't get angry at your developers if they're decompressing a little bit. So long as people are hitting their deadlines in my shop, I don't really micromanage them as far as their time's concerned. I make sure the expectations are clear for what they have to do, but their decompression time is their own. And I always feel better when I have a guy who's, I see on the web for a week or two, and then he comes to me and says, hey, I've been playing with this framework. This is how it's going to make our lives easier after the fact. So, and again, those new skills are going to contribute to your new projects and make things better in the future. So what are some of the benefits of this openness and collaboration? Well, you know, every development team is going to build a piece of software that falls apart. And then the finger pointing starts and everyone hates each other. The best way to get around this is to move the responsibility to the team when mistakes are made. If you guys have had peer review on all the different pieces moving through the life cycle, then it's really not any one individual's fault. There's at least two people involved, so at least two people drop the ball. And the best way to solve a problem isn't to find out who dropped the ball on it, it's to get it fixed. So if you're having the developers or the team work together to solve problems or work together to identify problems in the life cycle or with a particular project, it's the best way to do that conflict resolution. The best part about this is that after the mistake gets fixed, it's a success for the team. And the team will remember that mistake, and then maybe the next time they're coding, it won't get made again. So this is a really good way to spread blame. I'm not the kind of manager who likes to drag people in the room and say, hey, you broke this particular feature, so I'm writing you up or I'm firing you. I like to take that as an opportunity to say, what could we have done? What did we do wrong as a team where we could have avoided this problem ever happening at all? And if your developers aren't comfortable opening their mouths to speak about these things, then you're never going to hear about them, and your software is just going to get worse and worse. So we talked about building professional respect. I like to do team meetings. You need to do team meetings regularly because it kind of sets expectations from a timeline perspective. If I'm a developer, I go into my zone when I'm coding, and I don't want to be bothered until I'm ready to come out of the zone. So if my boss comes up to me and he's tapping me on the shoulder and saying, hey, where are you with the project, that's going to break my concentration. There's well-publicized studies that show it takes about 15 minutes to get back in the zone. So every time you as a programmer are bothered, it's going to take away 15 minutes of your time that you could be otherwise coding or being productive. So if you say to the developers, listen, every Monday at 10 o'clock we're going to have a meeting, they're prepared for it. They don't get in the zone before the meeting. Maybe they just kind of schedule their work for the week. And that way you can sit down with them and actually get some information, some feedback that you need to manage the team, but not disrupt their workflow. Keep your team meetings brief. If you've got a team meeting that lasts longer than a half hour, you're doing something wrong. If you have, you know, for some reason you're talking about a new technology, or maybe someone brings up a suggestion and the team is all actively involved in discussing that, maybe your meeting will last a bit longer. But you should try to keep them to about 30 minutes or less. I like to go around the room in a small enough team, maybe 10 people or less, and have everyone just briefly give us an update on what they're working on. Maybe say, hey, I'm having a problem with this. It's a great opportunity for another developer to step in and say, hey, maybe I can help you out with that, or kind of share ideas amongst the team. If you have a really big team, like the team I'm managing right now is about 18 people, if you go around the room, everyone's going to be falling asleep by the time you get around to the last person. So we do more of kind of a, I'll do a quick update with each individual, and then I'll kind of announce to the team where we are with the project and kind of what else is going on in the department. Definitely encourage suggestions and feedback in every meeting. I have managed teams where everyone's very vocal and outspoken, and I've managed teams where you have people who don't like to speak in the open, would rather come to you individually and give their ideas. If you're working in an environment where your manager does not accept your ideas and suggestions, I highly recommend you find another job. The only way for teams to truly get better and to step over problems that they're having and build better software is if their managers encourage suggestions and let the environment change. Something you'll hear a lot in software development methodologies and agile methodology is accept change for your software because it's inevitable. The same thing is true of your software development environment. Technology will move on, and the developers need to move on with it. So if you're a manager, keep that in mind. And if you're a developer and your manager doesn't get it, I'll give you my business card and they can give me a call. All right, let's talk a little bit about peer reviews. Again, there's lots of different stages in the life cycle where a peer review is appropriate. Looking at the spec, looking at either a functional or non-functional prototype, the architecture and design phase, code, there's lots of little interactions. If you're working in a waterfall life cycle where you have to do architecture first, it's absolutely essential that everybody gets a shot at looking at the architecture before the coding begins, because I've done the architecture role, and what we used to do is I'd get the whole team, we'd set aside an hour, and I would present the architecture to the team, and then they'd constructively poke holes in it or ask me questions about it. And this is a great way for us to step away from that meeting with a better architecture. And again, we never left the meeting without better architecture. There was always something that was missed. So if you're not doing reviews, accept the fact that there are things you're missing right now that are making your software lower quality. Again, the reviews create these learning and sharing opportunities. I had times where I was doing system architecture, and I would say, hey, here's how I did this. And some of the developers were like, wow, that's kind of cool. I didn't know you could do that with the technology, or vice versa. Here's another way maybe you can think about doing that. And we didn't always change things, but someone questioning the idea gives you the opportunity to really think about it again and have that fresh set of eyes and say, well, is this really the best way of doing what we're doing? And again, ultimately, the end product's going to be higher quality. So if your managers don't get why you're trying to do all these things, you can help them understand the quality of the code will be better. And you should be able to demonstrate that with the first or second iteration where you're using this open environment. One of the things that's really essential, the project has gone into production. Maybe it went really well. Maybe everyone hated being part of the project. Sit down with the team and say, what did we do well and what was really horrible about this project that we never want to do again? It's essential to getting better. Again, if your managers aren't doing it, you really need to push them to accept this, because the next project you work on is just going to get worse or stay the same if you guys aren't sharing your ideas and talking openly about the successes and failures. The best way to do this, you don't want to point fingers at anyone, always talk in terms of the team. I really don't think the team did a good job, looking over the requirements. I really don't think the team used this technology the way it needed to be. I really don't think the team was capable of using this technology. I think we might need some training. Being open and honest about your situation is going to be the best way to make it better. What you want to do, you don't want to just kind of get a list of problems and walk away. I always say to my team that the problem with no solution is just a complaint. I don't really like complaints. If developers come to me with a problem, I have an expectation that they've also got a couple of suggestions for how to fix it. If they don't, I really don't want to hear about it. But as developers, we're problem solvers. We normally know what we want. We just need the opportunity to actually be allowed to ask the question or make the suggestion and see if it's going to work. Have to accept the fact, too, that not all ideas will work. A lot of stuff falls apart, but at least if you try it out, in most cases, you're going to be successful and it's going to have been worthwhile. All right, so now let's talk a little bit more about development standards. Why are development standards needed? Well, you know, one of the things that a great software team has is clear expectations. If I don't have any development standards, there's no expectations on my work whatsoever. Also, if I got a couple of developers arguing during a code review about what's right and what's wrong, all you got to do is look at the development standards. They will tell you. And if you have your team create the development standards together based upon best practices that they all kind of agree on, or you know maybe majority rule agrees on, then it creates this kind of code of honor as regard to the code that everyone's going to want to adhere to the development standards. We had a time with a web team I used to manage at Westgate where you could not distinguish any developer's code from any other developer's code because we enforced our standards so stringently. Now, that may sound draconian, but the reason this is so effective is that you can open up work that someone else has done and it's as if you wrote it. It's very easy to understand. It makes your job really quite enjoyable. In fact, the only way we could differentiate between one person's code and another was the style of comments that they used. That was pretty much it. So how do we create these development standards? Again, hands up, who has development standards in their environment? So wow, again, much fewer arms going up than I'd like to see. Development standards really are essential. There's a couple of different ways that you can create standards. You can embrace an existing standards document, which is just going out and Googling Java standards or ColdFusion standards or Fusebox standards and ripping someone else's ideas off. You can go through brute force, which is where you sit down in a room and you lock the doors and you put on a pot of coffee and everyone tries to figure out the development standards all at once. Or you can kind of develop your standards as you go. Three different techniques. I have a preference. One may work better for you. So let's talk about each individually. If you take an existing standards document and apply it, that's a good quick way to have standards. I haven't found a great deal of standards documents that I would want my team to follow necessarily. You tend to find that each development team works a little bit differently based upon the individual mix of skill and experience that you have on your team. So this isn't really a good way of creating an open collaborative environment. This is more of a manager coming in and saying, we're going to use Sun's Java standard because I said so. I don't know if it's any good, but you know, this is what we're going to use. So you know, most teams operate differently, so you want to give them the opportunity to tweak the standards. And if they're not created by the team, there's no sense of ownership, so, you know, who really cares? So this isn't my favorite. Again, maybe it'll work in your environment. Trying to sit down and figure out all the standards at once requires a lot of time. I've seen it burn people out. If you're using a new technology, it's almost impossible to do because no one's experienced on your team yet to even set standards. If you have people who are experienced, you know, maybe not. Maybe it's an easier way for you to get that information from them. You know, it's really hard to sit down and just figure out all your standards and have them be right. That's normally not something I've seen work too well. The other thing I really hate about this is that it almost makes it like, we're going to get our standards done and then that's it. We're going to carve them into stone tablets and we're going to stick them on the shelf and that's it. And you need to be able to refactor your development standards over time as you find better ways of doing things, where your ideas are going to go stale, like, just like they would if you stuck with one technology forever. So my favorite approach, as you probably guessed, is kind of developing your standards on the fly. We just recently acquired Flex at Westgate last year. And you know, a lot of developers, as I would say, hey, we're going to go build this app, they'd say, oh, what's the development standard? What's this, that? You know what? I don't know. I've been using Flex for 6 months. I'd recommend we do this to start with, and then after you've coded for a day or two, why don't we talk about what you think? And it's a little bit uncomfortable for the developer initially, but the thing is, if you have regular conversations and you talk about the standards you'd like to implement, and you start documenting them immediately, you're going to build your standards on the fly. And it's also going to create a better impression that, hey, it's okay for these standards to change over time because each week, as you get more experience, the developer is going to find new ways to do things or maybe standards that didn't make sense that you can refactor out. So I much prefer this. It's very important, though, that you document what you're talking about right away because you want to have that document to refer to as the clear expectation. Otherwise, you and I just had a conversation, and who knows what we interpreted out of it. So with that being said, how do we actually go about documenting our standards? How many people in the room have a wiki at their job right now? A wiki, for those of you who aren't familiar, is basically an online encyclopedia. Most of them are written in PHP and they're free, and you can download them and just stick them on the server. Wikis are fantastic because they're web accessible, so they're like, it's instant access. You can search them. Most of them will kind of search and index themselves automatically. They support markup, so you can, you know, make documents that are actually attractive to look at and have some semantic meaning behind them. And a lot of them support embedding JPEGs and little videos and things like that, which can be useful when you're explaining more complex concepts. So I highly recommend documenting your standards in the wiki. We're actually getting our wiki up and running at Westgate, and the thing that's going to be really great about it is we're going to make each large project or each significant piece of the applications kind of have a landing page on the wiki, where if I'm a new developer and I get drafted into a project, I can spend an hour or two reading about the project at a very high level and get my bearings. And then there'll be links to the actual detailed documentation for each of the pieces of the system from there. So it's going to kind of become our developer reference point. If you don't have a wiki or you can't get one installed, there's nothing wrong with word processors or, you know, web pages to put the information on. Make sure you back up your standards. They're just as valuable as your source. So either set up a backup strategy or put them in source control, because you don't want to lose all that intellectual property you guys have built up over time developing your standards. Again, another reason the wiki is great is because if you're talking about an old standard you don't like anymore, you can just have someone with the right permissions hit edit and go in there and change the standard and save it. And a lot of the wikis actually archive previous versions of standards, or previous versions of documents, so you'll have a history of all of the standards that you ever had in your organization. Big point, if you're not enforcing your standards, they don't exist. I've seen a lot of really good standards processes come out with great documents, and you go back to the team 2 years later, and the software doesn't look anything like the standards document says it should. So all of your review cycles need to be based on standards, and a really great way to make it easy for these standards to be enforced is to make a checklist that accompanies each step in the process that just has kind of the mental processes or the particular standards that your developers should be paying attention to. It's going to make it easy for them to enforce the standards, and the easier things are, the more likely they are to happen. As a team manager, if you're not technical, find someone who on your team or a group of people who hold the responsibility of being the technical lead or the standards enforcement for a project. Because again, if you don't have it, they're just not going to be paid attention to and they're all going to go away. And finally, again, make sure the developers are comfortable bringing a standard back to the table. We've all had discussions at Westgate about how great our new standard is, and we all love it, and we all talked about it for half an hour at lunch and thought it was fantastic. And then we've been coding in it for a while and we're like, man, this is a lot of work. Let's do this instead. You want to make sure that you're constantly reevaluating your standards. You will find that over time, you'll get to the point where your standards are really not changing that much anymore because you've reached a comfortable level with them, but you should always be comfortable coming back to the table and changing an idea if it's going to make things better. All right, so let's talk about some things we can do on the job. How can we distribute our work? How can we take our developers, make them better developers over time? And what about documentation? Documentation's a very kind of important part of any kind of software development, so it's really important that we have some thoughts on that. A good work distribution technique, again, I've worked in shops where, you know, you have people who are junior developers and the mindset's kind of like, they don't know as much, so I can't give them anything. And a lot of that comes from time pressure, where we got to get this done, but I only have a handful of developers familiar with the technology. But what you end up doing is burning out your top developers, because they're doing everything, and then the other guys are sitting there like, why am I here? You know, I've mastered making little updates to stuff. I want to tackle something that's bigger. So you have to kind of accept the fact that you will lose some productivity by having a senior developer, a mentor, a junior developer, but the end result is you'll have two people who understand the technology, which will give you greater throughput later. And then the big time span of software development, you'll eventually end up making up the time and actually getting ahead of where you were. So you really want to promote mentoring and knowledge sharing amongst your teams and allow the junior developers to tackle new challenges and kind of spread that work around. What you don't want to have is knowledge silos. This is a case where you have one person who built something, they're the only person who knows how it works, and in the event that they get hit by a bus, everyone else would just say, I don't know how it works. So you want to make sure that you're spreading the work around enough so that different people, they may not be experts, but they at least have a level of familiarity with a particular system, and that way there's not this huge burden on one individual to get everything done. The team I took over at the beginning of this year had one guy who'd been working on the same part of the system for 2 years. And like everyone openly knew that he hated it. So the first thing I did was have him write a bunch of documents on how it worked and train someone else. And he's been the happiest guy on earth ever since. So doing that even distribution, I have something I like to call prima donna syndrome with developers, which is where you have the kind of sharp developer who's like, well, I'm too good for maintenance work. Not true. You're really a good developer. You can knock the maintenance work out in your sleep. So it also gives you the opportunity as a senior developer to look at something you built and say, hey, this thing's really easy to maintain. Or maybe not. Maybe you start changing it. You're like, man, this is a real pain in the butt. You know, maybe the next time I design a system, I'll make it easier to maintain. So there's a lot of benefits to rotating that work around and having everyone share the responsibility. This also results in high-quality, persistent documentation. Most people don't like being asked the same question over and over again. So if you have a particular system that you're spreading around and the guy who wrote it didn't do a very good job of documenting it, he's going to get sick of being asked all the time how it works. And hopefully, if you promote the right environment, we'll write a document that explains it better, or we'll create a page on your wiki with some diagrams and some examples. You should be encouraging this as the team manager, or encouraging this within your environment, and this will help you come out with high-quality documentation that sticks around and everybody refers to. New developer comes on the team, they can get their bearings and be productive very fast. So again, we talked a little bit. I'm a developer. Most developers don't want to be managers. Everyone who's a developer in here, put your hand up. And then all of you who want to be a manager someday and not be technical anymore, put your hand down. Or sorry, keep your hands up, rather. Keep it up. If you want to be a manager one day and not be technical again, and you're a developer, put your hand up. So not a lot of people. Most people don't want to be non-technical if they're technical. And unfortunately, the way that things have worked in the past is that the track that most shops create is like, well, you've been programming a while, now you can like build schedules and spreadsheets all day and talk to customers, you know. Most people don't want to do that. So the best thing to do is, if you have a team or any kind of business, whether it's consultancy or whatever, and it's successful, it's going to grow because you're going to have more work to do. And what will end up happening is you'll have a team that have maybe two or three technical leads and, you know, seven other developers, and then all of a sudden you've got 20 developers and you've still got the same three technical leads. If you're not growing your people, you're not going to have your future leaders. And if you have developers who are clutching tightly to something they built and they don't want to share it with anyone, you need to explain to them that if a promotion opportunity comes for you to be, you know, maybe a director or, you know, a higher level technical individual to direct software development, and you haven't shared anything, you know, I can't promote you. So you're actually going to hold yourself back from a career perspective. Some of the best advice I ever received in my career was to always be training your replacement. If you have that guy who's ready to step into your shoes, then at the point where things grow, you can step away from it. So definitely allow your experienced developers to mentor the junior guys. This is a great way to identify your future team leads. Obviously, not everyone can be a mentor. Some people lack it either personally or professionally to be able to do that. So at least you'll know who's who. And your senior developers who really are good at this are going to be rewarded because they're going to get that professional respect from the junior developers. So you don't even really need to create a reward structure for them. And then one day a promotion is going to come up. You're going to know who to pick. It's going to end up working out. We talked about knowledge silos. Making time for documentation. Documentation is really important. So you want to shoot for that just enough balance. Again, just enough is... I'm new to a project, and I can sit down and get my bearings on the project, and I can look at the code and kind of have a feel where things fit in. Best way to do this, I always say this, if you ever have a piece of documentation that can be drawn instead of written out in the document, draw it, because you can convey a lot more information visually a lot faster than you can through a written document. Obviously, you need a mix of both. I personally like UML a lot. Anyone here who's... learned UML, you can diagram anything in UML. I mean, there's literally a diagram for everything, and at least that way you have consistent notation everyone can refer to. Plenty of good UML tools out there for free you can get. There's a great book by Martin Fowler on UML. It's kind of like a UML in a nutshell style thing. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. But, you know, great thing to just have a copy of in the department and have everybody read it and start documenting things using it. So again, generally, less words, more pictures are better. And you're looking to just create that mental starting point, and then there'll be certain pieces of the application that need more information because they're more complex. So really what you're going to be looking for is, are people still asking questions each time they're exposed to a new part of the system, or do they read the documentation and they're pretty much good to go? When they're pretty much good to go, you've got enough documentation. And I would definitely not recommend over-documenting something for the sake of argument, because generally the more words and the more pictures you add to things, the bigger the documentation gets, and it actually becomes less comprehensible. So it's almost better to start with as little as you think you need and kind of work your way up. I don't know about the rest of you, but I've opened up code in the past, and there's a comment from 1992 from a guy whose name I can't pronounce and no longer works with the company, telling me that he implemented a new function that did something with the code. And to me, that's totally useless information. I don't care about what the code did 14 years ago. I care about what it does now. So as far as documentation goes, it should always be a current snapshot. What's the system doing today? How does it do it? What are the bits I care about? Anything else is just fluff. If you're using source control, you don't need to create histories of what's happened because you can go back and look at what the system was doing. So again, study work rotation will promote the good documentation. The questions will be asked, you'll know what to document. It's really easy to have a guy say, hey, I don't know how this works, and to take another guy and say, hey, you built this piece, can you supplement the documentation? Just spend the next hour putting something together. Good way to make sure your documentation is good is not have people talk to each other as much. Have someone produce some documentation and give it to the other guy and see if he gets it. If he doesn't, that's not enough. This is essential if you have a team where you might have high turnover, or you might have any kind of turnover. As you have new developers come in, they need to be able to come up to speed quickly. So documentation is part of your training process. And if you don't have it, you're going to have developers coming in and they won't be productive for months. And that's really not a good use of your money. I really believe in rotating developers between short maintenance enhancement work and longer projects. Maintenance work is usually really fast, little enhancements, little bug fixes. You get that immediate gratification of fixing the problem. Gives you the opportunity, again, to see a system in action, see how easy it is to maintain, which will give you ideas for how to build your next system architecturally. Keeps your debugging skills sharp if it's a bug and it's kind of hard to find. It's always good to keep those skills sharp for a developer. And anyone who's worked on a long project for a while, it gets monotonous. You get to the point where you're sick of working on the project, even in the initial development, and that last 5% of any project is incredibly draining, mentally and emotionally, for your developer. So you have to keep that in mind if you're a manager, and if you're a developer who's always on longer projects, you might want to suggest to your manager that you'd like to be rotated occasionally. Longer-term work is equally as important for any developer. Gives you the opportunity to apply those new ideas and techniques that your manager graciously gave you a couple hours a week to look at. Everyone should really learn how to design applications, because if I don't know how to design applications, I'm not going to design good enhancements to the application when I need to. I'm just going to make bad decisions about the way it's structured, and ultimately we'll end up with a mess. Also, if you can, and you have the ability to do parallel development, where you have maybe different developers working on different pieces of the system simultaneously, this is a great way to build that interactivity between teams and promote the communication. Anything that works in parallel from a development standpoint where the communication is bad is likely to fail. So it's very important. If you can do it, this is a good way to break the work up and end up making longer projects shorter by evenly distributing the work. So my recommendations, which I'll make to the managers here, and which I'll recommend the developers make to their managers if they have this. If you have a shop where you have a bunch of people who do nothing but maintenance and a bunch of guys that just do project work, you're kind of building a recipe for disaster. I'd highly recommend rotating the work around. The maintenance guys are going to end up with stale skills and bored, and the project-only guys are going to end up being prima donnas and never willing to do any of the maintenance work. So, and they'll probably start designing solutions that can't be maintained. So it's really important to kind of roll that stuff around. And once again, that last 5%, when you're done with a big project, ask to be taken off of it and maybe given something else to look at that's a little bit more rapid fire so you can decompress your brain a little bit. Okay, now interviewing and hiring is probably the most important piece of anything you can do to your team. And unfortunately, most people either don't know how to do it or don't pay enough attention to it. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this. How many people here have been interviewed for their job originally? Because I know some of you are independent contractors. So, and how many of you have been to just really horrible, painful technical interviews that you left and you're like, I don't even know why I showed up? So, now this happens quite a bit. When I became a manager from being a developer, I really didn't know how to interview. I knew how to write code. So I kind of went along with some of the ways that we traditionally interviewed people. And it was typically, you'd bring the guy in the room and you'd ask him like all these random questions about the technology that he could find in like 8 seconds on Google. And then if he could answer them all off the top of his head, he was a good developer. And if he couldn't, then you weren't really sure where he stood. So this obviously isn't the way you want to interview, but unfortunately is the way a lot of people in the industry do interview. The most important thing is, who you bring on your team is going to affect the performance of the team. Anyone here run tropical fish before? Kind of had like a little aquarium or something? I haven't, but everyone I know who has is always telling me, oh, I put this fish in and it ate all my fish. Or, you know, I added a rock that I thought was really pretty and it changed the pH balance and everything died. And that's exactly how development teams are. You bring in some narcissistic, developer who thinks they know everything, and you send them in there and they blow everybody off, and, you know, that's going to be a negative effect for the entire team. So you need to be very selective. It's better to have not enough people than it is to have enough people, but everyone hates three of them. So you always want to make sure that you bring the right people in. Adding that bad apple is definitely going to spoil the bunch. Also, if you have guys who are just, you know, not making it work in the environment, whether you're a manager or a developer has to work with this individual, and you know that life would be better if they weren't there, start campaigning to get rid of those people. There's probably a place for them somewhere, but if you care about your team, it's probably not on your team. So where are we placing value in these developer interviews? Again, random technical questions are totally useless. We've got the internet now, and we've had these things called books for a long time. If you need to look up a piece of information about the technology, it's real easy to find that information. What you want to do instead during the interview is engage in exercises that demonstrate communication ability and the ability for someone to work in a team. Because anyone who's coming into a team who doesn't have those qualities is going to fail, just going to be totally unsuccessful. You also want to make sure that you're involving some of your team members in the hiring process so you can get their feedback. Maybe you don't agree with all of their feedback, but at least you'll get an opinion of the candidate from someone else. This is especially important if you're a non-technical manager, because there's going to be things that you're just not going to see. So, what's the most useful question on this page? What's the argument list to struct find? That's really going to give me some insight into someone's thinking about development. Or how do you like to take a requirements document and turn it into a piece of working software? You want questions you can ask where, you're speaking 5% of the interview and the candidate's speaking 95% of the time. This is the kind of thing you can ask someone and they'll just rattle off for 10 minutes. You can just sit there and absorb, see what you're looking for. Here's another really bad one. What are the valid attributes of CF component? Or you can say, hey, what can the development team do to work smarter instead of harder? These are all things that good developers should have thought about or maybe have experienced in the past and can shed some light on. So how do we interview at Westgate? This is our top secret interview process that I'm not supposed to share, but I love everybody in this room, so just don't tell anybody. We have a 20-minute phone interview. If you get through that, we have a 30-minute technical screening exercise, and if you get through that, you'll come back for a one-hour in-person interview. Each of the steps has to be successfully completed for you to move forward. A lot of people don't make it past number two. I'll tell you that for free. So what are we doing in this 20-minute phone interview? Some of you have laptops, or even if you don't, we have a zip file in there that goes with my presentation. I have sample documents that show you some of the questions we ask on the phone interview, what our technical screening exercise is, one of them, and the questions that we ask during the main one-hour interview. So the 20-minute phone interview is really important because if you ask someone to come to your office to interview with you and you find out in the first 5 minutes that they're just not the right personality or you can't understand what they're saying, it's a lot less comfortable to kind of shoot them out the door than it is to have a phone call with them and put the phone down. So this is a great time saver. You want to do the interview with at least one other person there and the interviewer, so you can have like two people maybe ask questions or just a second opinion on how things went. Should be asking high-level, open-ended questions. And what you're looking for is, does the candidate have the right experience and capabilities? Can they communicate clearly? And are they a serial killer? A lot of times you'll interview people and you talk to them and they're like, yeah, thanks very much. Don't want to hire you. So one of the things I like to do is I print out the phone interview that I have, and I have a little white space on the page. And I like to jot down notes of the candidate's answers. This is useful for two reasons. The first is, if they do make it through the interview process, I can refer back to this information during the in-person. The second is, we live in a litigious society, unfortunately. If you have someone who's accusing you of not hiring them for a certain reason, you've got something to back up why you didn't take them any further through the process. So it's a kind of a good way to cover your butt as well. So here's the sample phone interview. I'm not going to read through all these questions and bore you guys to death, but some of my favorites are, tell us briefly about your experience. I've actually had people start reading me their resume at this point. What I try to do is guide people towards what do you think is important or interesting that you've done in your career that you'd like to share with me. Maybe pick one or two things. Asking someone what their strongest skills are is always useful. I mean, most of the technical resumes I get have just an army of buzzwords on them. I like people to tell me what they think they're good at. That's a really good way. And then you can maybe drill down a little bit and see if they really are as good as they think they are. If you're working with particular technology sets like relational databases or objects, it's always good to ask people what their level of design experience is. I found most people are honest about this. Hey, I haven't really done any database design or DBAs at all about. Or you have people who are like, listen, I kind of know how to program in Java. I've never actually built an object-oriented system before. And finding out what someone's career aspirations are good, especially if you're looking to do a long-term hire. And finding out why people are leaving the environment they're in. I have had people tell me, I just really hated my manager. The environment I was in didn't work for me. I've had other people who are just leaving contracts, so you never really know. But it's good to kind of know what people are looking for and where they're going, because hiring people takes a lot of energy and effort. You bring someone in to train them, and you can't provide the opportunities for them over the long term. You've kind of wasted your time. So this 30-minute technical screening, we use an exercise. The technical questions that you ask people, again, are totally useless. What I'm interested in seeing is how does the candidate think in an abstract fashion? How can they communicate ideas? What's their thought process? And, you know, each team is different, and you're looking for different qualities in your candidate. Great way is to get your team together and say, hey, what can we do that'll take about 15 minutes to do and then like 15 minutes to talk about with the candidate, where we can probe all the different qualities that we know will make someone successful in our environment. I'm not going to put the document up on the screen, but I'll just kind of give you a brief overview of our technical exercise that we have. One of the ones we do, you have an online bookstore that sells CDs, books, and DVDs. And right now, the customer goes in, they submit their order, and it shoots an email over to somebody who actually calls the customer back, gets their credit card number, processes the order, does the rest of it. So the scenario is you're the developer. You've just come in and taken over this particular application, and you've convinced them that they need some kind of automated credit card processing system so you can process orders online. Well, the stipulations are the credit card processing system has to be reusable if you built another website, and it has to be able to integrate with the existing system that we have right now. A couple other stipulations. And then we basically say to the candidate, you have 15 minutes. So you give us a high-level overview of how you're going to design the solution. They can do it on the whiteboard. They can do it on a piece of paper. They can write it in any notation. I don't care if you know UML or you just draw me a bunch of stick figures. It doesn't make any difference to me. Leave the candidate for 10 minutes. Come back and see if they have any questions. If they don't, come back, 5 minutes later, and then they have to present the solution to one or more people. Normally, we have a team of about 3 people in there that they'll present the solution to. I also tell them, make any assumptions that you need to about what the existing system does or what technology platforms you'd like to use. Keep it real open-ended, because I don't really care about your solution. I care about how you present, and I care about how you think about designing software. Most people don't make it through this interview. I don't know why, but there's a lot of people out there who've been programming in Java for 6 years who don't get objects-oriented programming. That or either Google got all of them. I don't really know. But this is definitely something that you want to do. About 15 minutes, you come back and you ask the candidate some questions. You'll be able to find out right away what their mindset is and if they're worth bringing on your team. This is a great opportunity to ask hard questions. You don't want to be polite during this interview. Sometimes people put a perfect solution up there on the board, and I still ask them stupid questions about it and drill into, like, why did you do this? Why wouldn't you do this instead? And I want to see if this person defends their work or backs down. And as they defend their work, do they do it in a professional manner, or do they get angry and frustrated? I don't want someone who works for me in my environment who's just a yes person and does what I tell them to. I want people to have their own identity. Again, your shot might be different, but you want to figure out what's important to you and conduct the interview in such a fashion that it screens these capabilities. Again, we talked about the OO design exercise. If you want to take a look at the sample that I put into the documentation, it is on your CD. The one-hour phone interview, really, the in-person interview, this is really a formality. If you've made it through the first two interviews, you're pretty darn close to getting the job at this point. But this is just for us to bring you back in again and in a more relaxed setting, actually talk. I'm trying to figure out what your personality's like. Can you hold a conversation beyond the phone interview? Are you professional? Some of the questions we ask in this interview, I'll kind of throw out for you. Again, I'll relate back to the notes I took in the phone interview, because then I have to ask the same questions over and over again. But I usually start the interview with, tell me about some of the noteworthy projects that you worked on, and tell us what your level of involvement was with the project. I'll let them speak. And then normally at that point, the candidate will talk for about 25 minutes. You don't have to say anything. Just sit there and listen. They'll tell you about all these different projects. Some of the follow-up questions I like to ask are, were you excited about the project? Did you like it? Or was it just terribly boring? What are some of the things that went well? What are some of the things that went badly? I've had people not be able to tell me that before. That's not good. There's always something wrong with the project. There's always something that was really great about it that you want to repeat. As a developer, you should be able to identify those things. How did you add value to the project? Did you do anything in particular that made you stand out? Some of the other stuff I love to ask is, tell us about the project that you worked on that you didn't like after you were done with it. Maybe your solution was horrible and you're just embarrassed about it. The first thing most developers do when they give you a piece of code is start telling you everything that's wrong with it and apologizing for the things that they haven't done yet. That's a good quality. You want to be self-critical. I have had people tell me before that they can't think of anything that, could be improved in their previous work. Right out the door. Extracurricular activities are very important. I like to hire people that love technology. You don't love technology, what are you doing here? Quite honestly, it's constantly moving. I like to find out what new technologies you're learning. Now, I understand some people have kids and they're married and, they don't have the time to look into new technologies. But I've had guys tell me, I'm constantly arguing with my wife because I'm on the serverside.com and the Cold Fusion forums and she's trying to hang out with me, and that's one of our touch points in our relationship. But, I like to know that people are interested in it even if they don't necessarily have the time. And most people at some point in their career, if they really love technology, actually spend some time building something themselves. Just a little project. I wanted to learn this technology. I wanted to build a website. Whatever. So they can tell you about something. One of the questions I love to ask, what are some of the things you do routinely to make your work easier to follow by other developers and simpler to maintain as the system evolves? Almost everyone just says, I put comments in my code. Well, that's great, but that's maintainability 101. How do you comment? Do you put meaningless comments in there? Do you tell me in your if statement what your if statement's doing? Or do you document pieces of the system that are significant that I need to pay attention to? How do you name your variables? How do you structure your system that you're building? You should be able to tell me 100 things as a developer and the way that you put your system together to make it easier to maintain as the system evolves. My absolute favorite question, how do you feel about documentation? That's it. Most open-ended question in the world. It's just a great one to see how they feel. Again, I've had every answer to this. I've had people tell me I don't like to put too much documentation in because I like to leave a little puzzle for the guy who comes up behind me. which is by far my favorite answer ever. Didn't get hired, but, comedian. I've had a lot of people tell me, I don't like documentation, but I get it. I see its necessity, and I do it, And you've got other people who are like, hey, I love writing documentation. That's my favorite thing. You'll get a feel for what you're looking for. Again, it might be different for you than it is for me. And I do have a couple of personality scenarios I throw in there as well. I give them scenarios like, you've got a senior developer who's telling you have to use a technology, and you know there's something better out there that you can use, but you've been told in no uncertain terms you have to use this technology. What do you do? Some people just say, I've been told to use that. That's what I got to do. You have other people who are, hey, I go to that developer and they say, look, I think this would be better, but if they push me hard, I'll still use what they use. I got people who said, listen, I'll just do it in the technology that I want to use because I think it's better. And again, depending on your shop, sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. I also have situations where I say, you've been given a project with an impossible deadline and a technology that you don't know. How do you go about handling that? And it's a great way to figure out, are you a book person? Do you like to go online? Do you read forums? Do you learn hands-on? Would you ask for training? All kinds of different things, because I can make intelligent decisions about our environment. If I don't have a training budget and you only learn stuff when I send you to class, you're not going to be successful here. So these are really important things to ask. And the most important question, I think, on the whole interview is, does the candidate have any questions for you? If they've made it all the way through, what do they want to ask you about the environment? And a lot of the times interview techniques will tell you if they don't have anything to ask, you don't want to hire them. A lot of times if you do your interview right, you've already covered everything. The interview should be a conversation. It shouldn't be this back and forth, yes or no, true or false, did you get the answer right kind of thing. And by the end of it, you should feel really comfortable with a mental picture of what that candidate's like and what they're going to bring to your team and whether or not you want to make them a part of your working environment. Because the truth is you're going to be sitting with them for 40 plus hours a week. Is it going to be worth your time? So that is pretty much it as far as the talk is concerned. I'd like to open up now for any questions and see if I can provide you answers. Yes, sir.
What do you do if people lie?
Great question. What do you do if people lie? The thing is, because our technical interview kind of screens people out from a design standpoint, it's not really a case where we've had a lot of people who could lie. I might have someone who fluffs me on how much Java they know. We've hired quite a few .NET developers for our Java side of things. But normally, anyone who knows how to structure a software system, the technology is just notation. If you think about mathematics, the best solutions are always the shortest, the most elegant, and the easiest to understand. Software is the same way. Some technologies do a really good way of expressing solutions that are XML-driven. Some of them are really good at expressing other things. So I'm not really worried about someone lying to me about a particular technology or how expert they are, because most people who are smart and pass the personality test can learn the other stuff. Obviously, if you bring someone in and they're not doing well, most companies have a 90-day policy and you're out the door. So we also do a lot of contract to hire at Westgate. Almost everyone we hire comes through a contract process. The purpose isn't because we like contractors, it's because it gives us 4 months to get rid of that person at any point with no liability if it doesn't work out. And the result of that is I think we've had 3 people let go in the last 2 years that I can think of. So it's been pretty successful. Another question.
So since the hiring process a lot of times is set up for resumes that have keywords, how have you found candidates that have these qualities you're looking for that are not some specific technology that a search engine?
That's a good question. The question was, since most resume search engines like Monster and other places like that, are keyword driven, how do you find someone who has these intangible qualities? The truth is that we have to start with the buzzwords. Like, I know I want guys who've done some Java, and if they've got Fusebox or Spring or Hibernate or some of these other frameworks, then they're probably kind of where I need to be. But the truth is the resume doesn't really tell you anything. I get resumes sent over by our recruiters, and they'll call me, they'll say, hey, I sent you a resume, and I'll open them in my email, and I'll look at them for about 3 seconds, and I'll say, okay, we'll get them on the phone. Because all I'm looking for is some of the frameworks and technology they've worked with. I know the resume is not going to tell me anything else. I know the 20-minute phone interview is going to tell me exactly what I'm looking for. And if that fails, the technical screening will do it. So that's kind of how we handle that. Any other questions? Right here? Okay. So to paraphrase and correct me if I'm wrong, but basically in an environment where there's not enough time to even do the work, where do you make time for the peer reviews? Is that kind of a good way of saying that? When I took over the web development team at Westgate Resorts, never been a manager before, adopted the SDLC that we were given, and was like, okay, this is how it's done. And soon enough, we had two projects fail, one on top of the other. And they didn't fail because we didn't program them well, and they didn't fail because we didn't understand the requirements. They failed because our life cycle didn't work. And luckily, I had developers who were willing to tell me why they felt things were falling apart. And they suggested that we look at this crazy new thing called Fusebox and the Fusebox lifecycle process. And they said, you did this whole thing where you prototype the system up front, and then you did architecture, and then you did coding. And I thought, great, so now it takes us 8 weeks to build a project, and we're going to have add another 8 weeks at the front of it in order to actually get through this lifecycle process. But we tried it. We figured, what the hell, it couldn't hurt. And what ended up happening is we spent 6 weeks doing the prototyping and the architecture and 2 weeks coding, and then we didn't have to maintain it because it was right. So the reason I've told that big elongated story is that you should find that the time becomes available as you build better solutions. There is definitely an investment in doing things right the first time, and it will take longer. But every software manual on earth, from Steve McConnell to Martin Fowler to whoever, will tell you that your longest cost and your biggest problem comes in your maintenance phase for software. So, you have to make the decision. Do we want to address the issues now, or do we want to spend the next 10 years of our lives dealing with them? Which one ultimately is going to save us more money and time? I'm proud to say that the web development team that I manage spends most of their time building new projects and very little enhancing old ones. The situation is completely upside down for the rest of our teams at Westgate. So, next question.
Given how much focus you put on during the interview process with their personal processes, if you will, once they're in your team and you're doing your peer review, are you still looking at personal processes or are you looking more at the products?
That's a good question. Question was, once we get the candidate in-house, are we looking at their personality more, or are we looking at the end result of what they're producing? The truth is, you can't really, as a manager or within a team, you can't really look at either quality. You have to have both. I'm looking for, is the candidate fitting in with the team? Normally, if you've picked the right personality match, you'll see some level of friendship or professional respect evolve very quickly, and that kind of camaraderie come into the team. If I have a guy who produces excellent technical work but is just a bear to work with and no one can work with them, That's not going to work. I need both in my particular environment. But I do look at both. I mean, generally, again, if you do the right job on the personality piece, that piece works itself out, and the person comes in and they're productive and they're fine. Again, you have to look at the quality of their technical work. Like this gentleman said earlier, what if they lied? You do have people fluff you up, and they come into your environment, and they don't pick things up quickly. So this comes back to clear expectations. I make sure that we give full training to the people that come into our web team, for example. Since we're so standards-based on like Fusebox and Spring and things, I can literally, we have like a whole packet we give the trainee that says, all right, here's your computer, here's your training exercises, here's your books. And the training exercises say, read, you know, chapters 1 through 3 of the Fusebox book and the first 2 chapters of the Spring book, and then there's an exercise for you to do. And when you're done with that, bring it to either myself or we have one of our technical leads look it over. Then they go on to the next phase. And within 2 weeks, they understand our environment. So then you can actually give them some work to do and see if they're picking it up. And ultimately, you just got to pay close attention to them, provide the mentoring support they need, and just make sure they have the right stuff. Unfortunately, in our other areas, we haven't quite gotten to getting the training program right, and we're addressing that at present. That's part of my new responsibilities. A lot of our guys come in, and there's very little documentation, and you know, we just kind of throw them in to the pool and see how they do. And maybe 6 months from now, they'll be productive enough to work on a larger project, but they spend a lot of time being confused and having to work things out for themselves, and it's not really pleasant for anyone. So I'm glad to say that's something we've identified that we're changing. Any other questions? Another one over here? The question was, how do you evaluate technical skills before you bring that person in for the technical interview? Is that correct? I will ask people, you know, what kind of frameworks are you familiar with? Or, you know, what's your level of experience with Cold Fusion? And you'll get different answers from different people. If someone says, oh yeah, I use Spring for this or Hibernate for that, great, tell me how you used it. What was the problem you were trying to solve? And you can kind of tell when people are fluffing you up because they either won't be able to answer the question. You know, you can dig in a little bit deeper. That the purpose is not to have the interview focus exclusively on individual technical questions, but obviously technical questions are an essential part of figuring out what people have done. And the best thing, again, is to say, well, what did you do with it and why did you use it? Rather than, okay, well, what does the beans config file look like and what's the XML node that you're using? Most people these days, with all their complete editors and stuff, won't know. But they should be able to tell you what the problem was and why that was an ideal solution. Anyone else? Question?
As a manager, how do you find time for yourself in your current situation to stay current?
To stay current with technology? The question was, you know, how does a manager with their current situation find time to stay current with technology? The truth is, these new Apples have a glow-in-the-dark keyboard, and after my girlfriend goes to sleep, I kind of stay up and go on the web. But, you know, I love technology more than I love sleep, so that works for me. And I'm also a techie at heart and a coder, so, you know, I'm more of a programmer than I am a manager, so that works for me. If you're just a manager in general, and you're trying to stay current, but are you technical? Okay, yeah, if you're a technical manager, I mean, you have to make the time for it. I mean, our interview process, I'm not going to kid you guys, it kills me to interview people. It takes basically half of my week to go through resumes and to do different things, but I'd rather do that and have other things atrophy and bring the right people in than, you know, not do that and kind of step out of it. But yeah, as far as technical and staying current, a lot of times I just go talk to the developers because I'm giving them time to find that out. You know, I'm asking them to present to the team something they researched. Or they come to me with a new idea and say, hey, I want to do this. Okay, great, we're going to take a half hour, you're going to present it to the team, and we're going to ask you questions. So I can learn the filtered down, condensed version of what they've picked up, where they've got all the important points, without having to spend 3 hours doing that same process that they go through. So that's another good way to kind of leverage up. A big part of Agile is don't repeat yourself. So if you've got someone in the team doing the research, no need for you to go and repeat that. Other questions? Yes? Okay. Good question. What do we use instead of Adalon? Those of you who've kind of been to my talks in the past or seen me around on the web know I used to be the user community advocate for Synthesis for the Adalon project. Adalon was a tool that was used to do visual documentation of Fusebox applications, and then it would auto-generate code based upon the visual model. So Adalon was really good for what it did at the time. We're no longer really using it because we're not using Fusebox as heavily as we did. We adopted the Agile, the Rational Unified Process at the end of last year. Anyone who tells you that RUP is overweight and too difficult to do is doing RUP wrong. Because RUP, when I read through all the documentation on it that comes from IBM, describes everything about Agile methodology. RUP is good enough to scale from like building rockets to, you know, building contact manager applications. So we've adopted RUP, and one of the things that's great about RUP is that IBM sells tools that directly support different pieces of the software lifecycle. So it does requirements management, UML and modeling, and development tools, and they all link together and work seamlessly. The big thing we took away from Adalon was that you don't want to waste time drawing documentation that you can't do anything with. If your developers can draw some UML models as they're thinking about it and push a button and some code comes out, there's some time they saved on writing the code. So I definitely say if you guys have methodologies, make sure you can find tools that make you, again, not have to repeat yourself or not have to sync up documentation. So we went with Rational. It was more expensive, obviously, than Avalon, but again, the benefit we'll get from actually having meaningful documentation will far outweigh the cost. Because right now, we'll spend 6 months adding a relatively small enhancement to a project because we don't understand how the system works. It's always that return on investment at the back end. Any other questions? All right, well, if you guys want to follow up with me after, you're more than welcome. I'll be at the conference through Sunday morning, and this is my email address and my website. So I appreciate you guys joining us.
Thank you for listening, and we hope we will see you at CF United 2007. This has been a production by TerraTech Programming. For more information, go to www.cfunited.com.